This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I was 17 years old. I was conscripted to the South African Army. And I didn't quite know what was going to happen. It was the sort of thing that you just didn't, you know, you were like put under pressure to get it over and done with. But having completed my basic training in the infantry, I was sent to the Namibian border, where I, in a very short space of time, realized that we were doing apartheid's dirty work. When I became a photographer, and that's also due to the militarization, I, at some point, handed in my rifle. I became a conscientious objector. I gave up my law degree and started taking photographs. And in a way, I started fighting back through the camera. This is one of the images that I took in my early part of my career. I just pitched up to this military parade. I didn't have a press card. And I took the photograph of our president, who was heralding the militarization program in South Africa. I met him again at a parade, Easter parade, and then I, in various ways, was kind of pretty obsessed with documenting militarization in South Africa. And then I also photographed the resistance movement to it. That's not on cue. That's apparently the radiator. But it does fit into the ambience. And this is a part of the group that I was part of, the End Conscription Campaign. These are friends of mine who were in a band called National Madness. But a very important part of this journey was my relationship to an organization called AfriPix. I'm a co-founder of the organization, and we called ourselves the Taking Sides Generation, and it comes from a movie that some of you might have seen called Under Fire, and Nick Nolte is the hero, and he gets caught in a kind of a raid with some local activists, and he's in a jail. He's in jail, and they ask him, they say, "Whose side are you on?" He said, "I don't take sides, I take photographs." Of course, the whole film changes. So we called ourselves the Taking Sides Generation. We were unabashedly partisan, and I once wrote that the camera is a weapon against the system. Somewhat embarrassing on reflection, but those were the times that we were in. It was, you know, a very, very tough time. And it's really, if you understand the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, it's very, very similar. You know, we were in a civil war, really caught up in it. We did very similar things. We were part of an alternative press. We got the message out, you know. We did what the mainstream never did. And many of us worked for this organization called Staff Writer, this magazine. I photographed the 1980 elections in Zimbabwe. And for South Africans, this was the first time they had seen a freedom fighter, a guerrilla. And on the other side was Bob Marley, who came to sing, and shortly before he died. So this was sort of like, it just fed into the sort of the artery of resistance, if you like. So just to understand, you know, something of the climate. So we worked in the field of culture, which, you know, broadly, you know, consisted of photography, art, writing, theater, and it was an avenue of resistance that wasn't overtly political, so we kind of moved in those spaces. And Andries Oelofsen talks about the value of artists and resistance, sometimes minimized, but actually highly important and incredibly necessary. So in terms of the circulation of images, I mean, here's an example. This is a photograph of mine. I kind of managed to get into a factory. And those days, getting into a factory to photograph workers was almost impossible. I managed to get in because I was working for a magazine called Leadership that looked a bit like Fortune magazine, and David Goldblatt was the editor of it. So I went in there with my color camera. I photographed in color and I photographed in black and white. I gave him the color version, and the black and white version went to the alternative press, the anti-apartheid movement around the world. That's the original photograph. This is another photograph that was, you know, on the front line. It was used in a poster. This photograph by Julian Cobbing of what was called the Cradock Four, and these comrades and activists were all murdered. No, it's not Biko. No, it's after, a number of years after. This is a photograph of mine that was used and cropped very badly for a poster. And similarly, you know, to the photographs you're seeing on the walls, we had exhibitions, sometimes in galleries, but often in community halls, church halls. And here are just some examples of the exhibitions we had then. We don't have a good record, unfortunately, so just take it from me, it did happen. So in building the archive and this collection of photographs in AfriPix, we were a threat to the state. And in 1986, they raided us and took all our archives, all our photographs. And there was a sister organization called Afroscope that worked in film. They took everything. And it was used for a treason trial. I had to leave the country. I worked for Der Spiegel at the time. I took an extended assignment, and I was kind of out the country for a number of months. The person on the right-hand side of this photograph was actually a plant by the security police, and I'm sure she had a lot to do with it. A few years later, the building in which AfriPix was housed, where the South African Council of Churches were, called Khotsa House, was blown up. I can only imagine she also played her hand. There are some seminal anthologies that we did in the time. So one of these was called The Cordoned Heart, which came from a project called Poverty and Development. And you've got to see that in somehow kind of in the same light that you would see the American Farm Security Project of the 1930s. The only difference is that we weren't paid, and we actually just we were paid expenses. So here are some of the images from that important book. Some of the photographers came from AfriPix, and a number of them were not members of AfriPix. But in a sense, it was an insight into how black people were living in South Africa under apartheid. The first inquiry into poverty in South Africa looked at white poverty, and this was the second. So this is farm labor and various essays. Of course, there are similarities between South Africa and the United States. There was segregation, but in South Africa there was systematic removal of the indigenous people. And here, a photographer followed the removal of people in the Eastern Cape. Then removal in a different way. Many people were forced into very cheap labor and worked on the mines. So there was another kind of forced labor, if you like, happening. Not all these photographers were, you know, photographers with a capital P. They were kind of sometimes amateur or just committed activists. And this person was a journalist, actually. But the seminal essay of the time was by David Goldblatt. And this is from a project called The Transported, which poignantly showed how people who were living in a homeland in the outskirts of Pretoria would travel 4 hours a day by bus to come and work and then return. So they were actually traveling 8 hours a day and working 8 hours a day and getting paid peanuts. So it just kind of really symptomized the, you know, incredible oppression people were facing. The sequel to The Cordoned Heart was one, this project called Beyond the Barricades, which looked at the resistance to apartheid. And it's more in the genre of what active stills do. This is a photograph that I took outside Chotza House on May Day. And May Day was banned. It was still in a time where you couldn't celebrate May Day. The workers couldn't celebrate May Day. And various images. This is a very amazing photograph by a black photographer who followed the death squad and took this picture, hiding in a township house. So there would be a cycle of funerals, not unlike what happens in Palestine today, where Palestinians live. There would be resistance, activism, people would be shot, killed, and then there'd be another funeral, and then so the cycle would just continue. This photograph was of an activist who had been hanged, and the correctional services official was coming to tell the family that he'd been hanged that morning. That's Archbishop Tutu. And these photographs are by someone called Gilda Flick. She was not an established photographer. She was a housewife. I gave her a quick crash course in photography. Showed her how to use a camera, how to develop and print, and the rest is kind of history. She worked amazingly. These are photographs by Gideon Mendel, who's and a very established photographer. And this is like a fight over the flag. And the flag here was the ANC flag. And I've seen similar pictures, you know, from your collection where people are fighting, jostling with the police over the flag. And this is the celebration of the flag. But in a time when to be seen to be aligned to the African National Congress, which was banned, would definitely get you in jail for a long time. I mean, I know people who, at a kind of a concert, musicians, at the end of the concert said, "Viva the ANC, viva Amandla," and they got charged and jailed for 4 years. At a certain point in time. So what I really also want to share with you is the parallel archive. So, you know, we often are understood as struggle photographers who worked in the struggle, but actually there was a kind of parallel archive that disrupts that notion of struggle photography. And we're looking at photographs that were much softer documentary photographs of the ordinary people of every day. And through that magazine, Staff Writer, we would organize annual exhibitions. And many people outside of AfriPix would participate. And that's how we kind of like built a momentum of, if you like, visuality against the state. So as you can see, there's a variety of photographs from a variety of spaces and classes and people in South Africa. These are rare photographs in the gold mine. And then, you know, amateur and not so established photographers would sort of sit side by side against luminaries like David Goldblatt, who always participated in these anti-apartheid exhibitions. And this is some of his work. And then photographers in exile, George Hallett, was living in London at the time, and he photographed musicians and exiled writers and poets. This is an essay by Santu Mofokeng in the 80s, who wasn't a very good sort of struggle photographer in the sense he didn't like the action. He far preferred the softer documentary style approach. And this was an early essay of his called On the Trains, Church Trains. Another photographer called Paul Grendon is another example, photographed in a very lyrical way the removals of this group of people who lived in a place called the Richtersveld. They were of Khoi descent, so they were also first people. But the way apartheid dealt with all people who weren't African was they just collapsed them into the term colored. And so they lost their language, they lost their culture, and their land. It just went by itself. And this series of images by Omar Butcher in a place called Grey Street in Durban also speaks to the sort of lyricism of the documentary movement at the time. We also had a photographer called John Liebenberg, who photographed in Namibia, and he basically documented the struggle and what was happening there. This was on the border, and that could have been me in one of those military vehicles 10 or 20 years before. These are recruits, and then, you know, the soldiers kind of, you know, having a break, and people on the front line, Southwest African People's Organization, the liberation movement that finally liberated Namibia, and the atrocities that were committed by the army and the police at the time, the return of the soldiers, and finally the elections that brought liberation. In similar vein, in 1990, Nelson Mandela was released, and this was a photograph that again illustrates the sort of documentary approach by our photographers. Hardly any of them photographed the sort of moment that was sort of taken by the wire photographers, and this moment taken by Chris Lederhofsky is kind of like a painting. It's like incredibly successful and lyrical and poetic. So, you know, we just took photographs, and then Afropix died a slow death, as many collectives do. It's not unusual. And then people would write about us. And, you know, we became sort of fair game for academics to kind of write about our legacy. And as I've become an archivist and, you know, I kind of got into the picture, I started to like consider what these narratives were. And many of them are, quite honestly, misrepresentations of what we did. So Svea Josephy talks about struggle photography as an overcoded didactic public message, very critical of what we did. She's completely ignored, as I've just shown you, the lyrical, the other parallel archive. The famous Okwi and Wizo, spoke about our work as being in the service of news reportage and ideological struggle against apartheid. And Zweletu Mtetwa, a black photographer, said that, you know, township residents were doubly oppressed by the system and by the representation that photographers like myself and colleagues in AfriPix were giving people. Also quite problematic. On the other side, people have written very positively about the movement, and Joyce Zinsky, who wrote in Staff Writer magazine, said documentary photography made a contribution to culture in precarious times, and it really was the case, and went on further to say that each image was a victory against the system, which was also supported by a very famous intellectual in South Africa called Albie Sachs. So documentary photography, as those of you who've read about it and studied it, has come under quite a considerable critique over the last three decades. Darren Newberry, who wrote a book called Defiant Images, said this, and I think it's important to understand our genre or our contribution to the genre at the time. And he said, unlike Europe and the United States of America, where during the 1970s and 80s, documentary photography had been problematized to a point of paralysis, in South Africa there persisted a strong sense of its value as a means of commenting on issues of social political importance within a visual public sphere. At the same time, the charge of naive and uncritical humanism that had been leveled at documentary photography elsewhere did not apply. And primarily because we were not just photographers, we were activists. We took sides. We were involved in the struggle on numerous levels, not unlike active stills. So in the early 2000s, you know, just sort of catching up with myself and catching up with the country, I produced a book called Traveling Light, where I kind of reflected on my body of work from that time. I'll let you read that rather than dictating it. And so I think what I really need to say about that is, while I was on the front line and taking pictures, I was also way off the front line, and I was in sort of these spaces where people lived. So I danced between the spectacular and the ordinary, if you like. And these are some of the images from my archive and my collection. So the two young girls on the right were part of a community that were being removed under the Group Areas Act, which basically said that all people of color who lived in the city would have to be removed and moved out. And these two young white kids walking past, kind of unbeknown and kind of, you know, unaware of the historical moment at the time. Well, this was in a sort of Shebeen place where women plied their trade. I was rather young and I was riding a bicycle, and they invited me in to have tea, and I stayed for tea. Just tea. And then I, you know, would sort of spend weekends, you know, walking the city and doing things that are, you know, not particularly profound or meaningful, but, you know, I love these photographs, you know, what ordinary people do, playing cards, these portraits. And then in the mid-1980s, at the height of the sort of struggle against apartheid, Santu Mofokeng and I did a project called Going Home. He went to Soweto, we're exactly the same age, and I went back to my hometown, which is near Durban, called Pietermaritzburg. I grew up there, went to school there, you know, kissed my first girlfriend there, and so on. and these were images from my hometown. which had a lot of colonial trappings, if for those of you who are observant to the architecture and the space. I mean, you know, they sort of aped the, you know, colonial system, you know. This could be Eton or Harrow, even though it was like a state school. And they played rugby and cricket, things like that. And they had flower shows. And that's the sort of graduation of school dance. The celebration of the Great Trek by the Afrikaner community. And then I photographed, you know, the landscape, people living on the land. This is in Cozy Bay. And in 1984, I had begun a project on the Sand People, the first people of Africa, probably the first people of the world. And this was a project that I did then, who were also caught up in the militarization, and they were part of the army, which had a devastating effect. So as I've said, you know, there was this tension between the spectacular and the ordinary that ran right throughout, not just my work, but through all the photographers in AfriPics. And then we decided, and I felt it was very important, that we should speak back. And I curated a project called Then and Now, with 8 different photographers who are from the collective movement. This is what David Goldblatt said. I don't speak about creativity, it's not part of my vocabulary. I simply wanted to work, to take photographs that were, as far as I could make them, penetrating of the time and the circumstances in which we lived. That was my concern. And what he said about now, which is very interesting and very Goldblatt-ish, is that, you know, once you look at values, there is no continuation, there's no break. There's just a continuation. I'm still concerned with our values and how we are expressing them. So here are some of Goldblatt's photographs from that period, which again underscore, you know, his lyricism and looking at not just the front line, but how people lived in numerous ways. He also photographed people in Soweto. And that photograph on the right, while we were taking photographs of people, you know, in the front line of action, is of a young boy who was tortured and had his arms broken. And that photograph, in a sense, speaks as loudly as a photograph that we would consider a wire photograph or a traditional photojournalist photograph. Interestingly, in the mid-1980s, he confessed to me and he said he thinks that his work as a photographer is meaningless and that what we're doing on the front line is more important. He didn't have the skills or the courage, he said, to take those kind of photographs. Rolling the clock on 30 years later, how wrong he was. George Hallett, this is his work from District 6. Cedric Nunn. And then, you know, celebratory images like this, you know, young kids surfing against the grain. It's not the kind of expected image that you would have thought would have come out of South Africa in the 1980s. And then he started on a project about his own family called Bloodlines. Guy Tillim photographed in the Transkei. This is my contribution. And as I say, the camera gave me a wonderful opportunity to explore and understand the world around me. And this is a photograph that I took in a place called Pageview. I used to play cricket for the team. I mean, you know, that was a sort of a knock-on after my school days. I continued to play cricket. I played cricket in the non-racial league, which was, you know, a big thing to do because even sport was segregated, unlike America. So I played in a team, black team, and my friends were being removed in the center of Johannesburg at the time. Graham Williams' photographs, Giselle Wilson. And yeah, finally, just to sort of round off, because the sort of conversation still continues around our archive and photographs during apartheid and after apartheid, and there's a tendency to for people to be very like didactic and draw a hard line between what was taken then and what is taken now, and then kind of try and force an argument and force a kind of dialogue. And we are still discovering photographs now that speak to then, if you know what I'm saying. One of those collections of photographs and archives are about vernacular photography. And vernacular photography was actually happening all the time, but it never kind of was seen as important or had the same value attached to it as did photojournalism or documentary that was speaking to the big political issues at the time. But to pose and to like present yourself to the camera was also a form of resistance, dressing up in style, you know, in a time of war, in a time of civil war. You know, we've started to understand this more and more. I have certainly, that there were just, you know, many, many levels at which photography was taking place beyond the front line. So here are photographs. This is an exhibition that I did called with David Goldblatt and Peter Magabani. And these are photographs I took of them in action. That's Peter Magabani over there in a very difficult situation where someone had been hacked to death. And there's David Goldblatt, who pitched up to Nelson Mandela's first rally in Soweto with a 4x5 camera. I mean, no one in the world would do that except David Goldblatt. So this is what David Goldblatt said about his work. Something in reality takes me, it arouses, irritates, beguiles. I want to approach, explore, see it with all the intensity and clarity that I can. Not to purchase, colonize, or appropriate, but to experience its isness. And it's still this in photography and in photographs. Peter Magabani said something far more kind of close to where he was coming from. Some of us have to use our pens, some of us have to use our cameras to tell the story. My camera is my mouthpiece for liberation of the people. I wanted to expose the system of apartheid, and the world heard my cry. So both photographers worked in Johannesburg in different ways, the city. This is a photograph of Magabani on the left, David Goldblatt on the right of Soweto. David Goldblatt also worked in Soweto. It's not his more well-known work. And here are photographs again of Magabani and Goldblatt in Soweto. And just sort of note the different styles, approaches, of the two photographers. I mean, the one is shooting primarily on a 2¼ square on a tripod. The other one is working in the genre of Robert Capa, Magnum, F8 and Be There. This is Magabani's seminal work on 1976, and I'm sure you're familiar with this. And you know, in conversation, here is Goldblatt's picture of 1976 that speaks to the moment. And in Afrikaans, it's an advert, says, "This is our new world. Read the morning newspaper for the new generation." Exactly. I mean, how does he get into this image? Anyway, he's there. I mean, he was always there. here is Goldblatt's, you know, seminal work on the mines, of which you, I'm sure, are aware of. And this is Peter Magabani's much more hard-hitting image of recruits coming to the mines. And then finally, Goldblatt photographed the Afrikaners. It was a book called Some Afrikaners Photographed. It's very well known in world circles as in photography. And amazingly, Peter Magabani photographed Afrikaners as well. These are the same people who tortured him for 500 and put him in solitary confinement for 580 days, detained him, banned him, burnt down his house. And this is what he said. I never asked for names. It made them nervous. And so I told them, I just took a picture and said, thank you, and left. They're my people too. We are all South Africans, and we've got to try to be closer. You are openly accepted by the Afrikaner of today. You don't have to be a well-known person for them to accept you. They liked me. They called me the Zulu Boer. The Zulu Boer. And a Boer is like a term for an Afrikaner.
Yes.
So the Zulu Boer. So finally, just on reflection about this journey and about South African photography and the sort of layers in which we've traveled, at one of the recent exhibitions and book launches, a critique made this comment. The mystery of South Africa is how such a small country can produce such a large number of internationally recognized photographers. Figures and Fictions explains why this has happened, placing contemporary South African practice, especially documentary practice, in the political and historical context, and also helping us expand our understanding of what photography can be and how it can get under the skin of those who view it. In a way, it's still a kind of mystery. I mean, I have some ideas of why South African photography kind of works. But the mystery continues, thanks for sharing the journey with me. And I'm very happy, of course, to answer questions and hear your thoughts.
It seems to me that from doing research on AfroPix, so at the beginning there was this kind of sense of different positions, photographic position between, let's say, the AfroPix generation and David Goldblatt, right? In the famous Botswana conference, he was marked as this kind of conservative photographer that believes in the liberal ideas, right? And you were kind of aiming for taking sides against the notion of photographic objectivity. So it seems to me that your journey as a photographer, archivist, curator has been to reevaluate Goldblatt and his work. You're really concerned with his work in recent years. And I was just wondering, what made you push in this direction? What made you rethink your original position? What do you think changed?
Oh, it's a good question. So when I went to David Goldblatt in 1982, just after AfroPix had formed, and he wanted a photograph that I'd taken for this magazine that he was the picture editor of, and I said, we're going to form AfroPix. And he said, that's a recipe for disaster. The security police are just going to come and raid you. And he was right. I mean, you know, 3 years later, they came and raided us. But at the same time, he also understood that what we were doing was pushing against the grain, working against the grain. Had we just sat there in our comfort zones and said, you know, c'est la vie, what can we do? I don't think a whole lot of things would have happened. So we took a position, and actually David came on board with us. He was part of what I call the collective movement. He never was a member of AfroPix, but he was, you know, completely supportive of our intentions. And as you can see with projects that we did, like the Cordoned Heart, he made a contribution in his own way, which was brilliant. He wasn't there in Beyond the Barricades because by his own admission, he was a useless photojournalist. And he felt he was really, like, limited. And so we developed this conversation. We're coming from different places, but we actually had that connectivity. And over time, you know, we got closer and closer and closer together. And then when I became an archivist, you know, with a capital A, and I got employed at the university, I worked with David, you know, very, very closely, but all South African photographers, to try and find a home for our memory and for the world to understand who we are, and find those scattered collections, because when we got raided, they went everywhere. And that project still continues. And, you know, the archive is very, 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 very key to one's sense of memory, one's sense of value, you know, wherever you are in the world. And sometimes it's a struggle in itself to hold that archive. I can imagine how difficult it is in Israel and with the Palestinians to hold on to an archive that, you know, serves as their memory, not only to the past, when they lived in Israel pre-1948, but also to, you know, all the journeys they've taken since their refugee status. So in that sense also, I'm a little bit of an old school archivist. I don't, you know, give up on the value of the archive. And particularly in a country where, like South Africa, where we need to remember, we need to understand the past so that we can move forward.
Since we're hearing you talk within this exhibition of Active Stills, can you maybe think about a way to talk about the similarities and differences between AfroPix and Active Stills, considering the time, the different geographical, political context and all that?
There are, and there, you know, you know, in terms of like frontline photography, being aligned with the left, being aligned with the resistance movement, AfroPix was very, very similar to Active Stills. But we sort of found ourselves in a situation where we could create a momentum by making our work available through the anti-apartheid movement, the alternative press, and the struggle organizations within the country and throughout the world. And then we did a dance between the gallery and the informal gallery. So we kind of strategically used both. And I see Active Stills probably more on the side of, you know, the people's gallery, the community gallery, the walls, and I think that's maybe a difference. But of course, in those days we didn't have the internet, and so your work is kind of available to millions more people than would have been us anyway. I think one of the differences is, I think you are at a point where your preoccupation is with a particular struggle in visuality and making a whole lot of political points that has consumed you. I know exactly that place, and that your opportunity to like speak to the ordinary as opposed to the spectacular and the political movement that in the political pressures that are on you is could be seen as indulgent or, you know, not a priority. And we found ourselves in that place too. And that's why it was only, you know, 15 years later that I could produce a book that spoke to these other photographs that I'd spoken. At the time, they just didn't have currency. So I think that's a kind of interesting place where you are at. And it also brings into question, you know, how you speak. You know, while it's very important to cover the political events and have a record, it's also really important to go beyond the front line and tell these softer, more human stories that have a different sensibility.
I think it was at the beginning of the talk, but you said something about taking position or taking a side in your images, and I'm just wondering if you could talk more about that, how that happens and how you try to do that in photographing something.
Well, you know, let's look at it more generally. I mean, taking sides was kind of set out for me because I was, as I said, I was conscripted into the South African Army. My job was actually to work for the apartheid government and kill people. And I was 17 years old and I didn't have the strength and the courage to resist it then. But when I did, I made a clear decision for myself that I'm not going to do that, as many South Africans did. And so taking sides was kind of organic. It just like, it would have been the same if you were like living in America in the 1960s and 70s and you were drafted into the army. There was a considerable resistance to fighting in Vietnam. And then of course we had to be very skillful in taking sides, because if we came out and we were partisan and too partisan and, you know, carried the flag, as it were, we were just heading for disaster. They were going to arrest us. They were going to put an end to the organization. So we had to be very strategic. And when we were confronted by the police and they said, "What are you doing?" We said, "We're just taking pictures. We're not taking sides. We're taking pictures." But of course we were taking sides. So we kind of turned that argument around. And, you know, many of us were involved as activists in these organizations. So the kind of connection between activist photography and what we did was just kind of, again, a continuum. And the people who joined AfroPix joined knowing that. So not everybody joined AfroPix. A number of people didn't feel comfortable. They didn't, you know, they chose not to be in such a partisan organization. And yeah, you know, we attracted not just professional photographers, but, you know, strays, waifs, hippies, they were all welcome. We had a very open agenda. As long as you were kind of committed and you kind of pointed your camera in the right direction and your pictures were kind of okay, you got the thumbs up, you know. So, and we were also very non-competitive, which helped. You know, it's about positionality in your head and where you actually are on the ground, being at places that you can anticipate. I mean, a lot of things happened and people didn't cover them, right? So that May Day photograph, I was definitely tuned in. There were other photographers around there, Associated Press, Reuters. And I knew just from my, you know, own sense of history that May Day is contested, it's banned. This woman is coming out to protest and there's a moment here that I really need for history. So I was primed, I was tuned in. So I think that's, you know, part of it happens in your head and part of it just happens anyway. I mean, so those photographs of militarization, I mean, I was taking them with a very specific intent. I wanted to show the world that, you know, this is what's going on in South Africa. It's a military state. I mean, other people who were working for local newspapers would have photographed them, and this is our president, you know. They might have got something similar, and they would have been happy. I wanted to get something outstanding to actually really rock the boat. And that was what was driving me as an activist. You know, I can't just do something mediocre. I'm not just pitching up, you know. And I wasn't being paid. I mean, this was just in my own capacity. So into these situations, I kind of like would get, okay, we got to make this work. So that's, in a sense, where the activist takes over the lens. Just to give you a context, and it would be the same now in Israel-Palestine, where there's a kind of currency around photographs, that these particular kind of images are seen as valuable. And the photographs, the softer photographs, the kind of more ordinary photographs, while they might be acknowledged, just don't have the same gravitas and momentum. So, you know, many of us came from a school and we kind of learned eclectically. You know, we read Life magazine, we'd heard about Magnum. You know, and South Africa was quite isolated. It was during the cultural boycott. You know, so it's not like, you know, we were sort of completely integrated with the world, and the world saw us as a pariah. You know, they saw us as this no-go area. So we, you know, we whatever we got, we took. And we read stuff, and we heard about the German workers' movement, the Photo League, we absorbed that all, and we rolled it into one, you know. So many of us were very aware of this other genre of documentary, you know, the telling of stories, the softer documentary, you know, Cartier-Bresson, you know, that kind of work. And we kind of aspired to that as well. So we were on the front line. Sometimes it wasn't our first thing and we weren't initially that good, but we did it. And then we continued with these long projects. And all of us had these longer projects going on at the same time.
Thank you. So we have this long, not very long, but kind of a last year's discussion in Active Stills about documenting issues inside 48 Israel and whether we should continue being engaged with the Israeli public and its social concerns or economical concerns. And so I was wondering, we were talking about this a bit in the emails, and so I was wondering whether what was the importance for you and AfroPix to document white issues in South Africa at the time, and what was the weight and this kind of looking into history and deeper history and into the future, and where did that kind of, like, how do you see it today, or do you even see that work important today in retrospect?
As a white person, one had access to certain things in the country, and the black photographers had also, like, privileged access to things in the country that were happening much easier for them on a level than the white photographers. So we understood those things. So it was very easy for me to go and stand 2 meters away from the president of the country and photograph him at a parade with no press card, just on the assumption that I'm part of the clan, right? He didn't know for 1 minute that those photographs were going to be circulated through the world, through the anti-apartheid movement, posters, and they were, they really were. So it would be very, very difficult for a black photographer in those days to have done that. But, you know, I think when I turned the camera on myself, as you saw in the 1980s, I wasn't doing it from a position of hate. I was doing it from a position of humanity. Trying to understand, as I was trying to understand myself, you know, these are people who are pressured into these positions. And I looked at them as compassionately as I could, even though I didn't agree with many of the things. And in the long term, there are always more than one side to history. One needs to look at history in a 360 way, that there are component parts that make part of that history. And that would be as pertinent today in Israel and Palestine as it was in South Africa then. And then, of course, you know, one did what one could. You know, I mean, Santu Mofokeng could do those beautiful pictures on the train and the churches. Very difficult for me. People would be, you know, not initially hostile, but it would be it would take a lot of work and persuasion. Whereas I could go into a factory, you know, and show them Fortune magazine, and the doors open, and things like that. So we were very strategic about how we could be effective from where we were coming and our positionalities.